Welcome to the sermon podcast of South Hills Church in Costa Mesa. My name is Chris Kretzu, and I'm the campus pastor here. Thank you for carving out the time to listen to this today. I hope that you will be encouraged and challenged, and ultimately that you'll have a deeper sense of God's love for you. I'll be back after the message is over, but until then, I hope that you enjoy this episode. A few months ago, my wife and I celebrated our anniversary. We went down to San Diego for the weekend and hung out and rode bikes all over the place and ate a lot of incredible food. And there's this one restaurant there that I was really looking forward to going to, but I forgot to make a reservation. And so we went to the restaurant and there was a wait. It was a 90-minute wait. How long are you willing to wait for a restaurant? I was willing to consider it. And so we put our name on the list, and then we decided, let's just walk around, see what else this neighborhood has to offer. And so we just start walking, and we're like, you know what, if we find something else, that's great. But, you know, it's like we're kid-free, so, you know, if I need to wait an hour for the incredible food, I'm okay with that, but don't need to be locked in. So we're walking down the street, hanging out, talking, having a great time. There is a spot that has a sign out front, big sign, chalkboard, all the stuff, and it's 90s night. So I was interested. I'm a 90s kid. And so we go inside, we pay the cover fee, we go inside. There's really almost nobody in there, and which is, as now almost 41-year-old, it's my perfect kind of 90s night. Not a lot of people, just get to hang out, listen to good music. Well, in the course of about 30 minutes, this place just absolutely fills up. It is packed, standing room only. There's apparently a dance floor all of a sudden, like the middle of the room became a dance floor. And so Ez and I, we were in there, and we kind of, as people were coming in, you know, we kind of just kept getting pushed back further and further. And before we knew it, we were standing against the DJ booth. And this DJ booth, for whatever reason, is, I've seen a few like this before, but it was actually kind of like built into the room. Like there was a wooden wall and this frame and a window, and the DJ was behind that. And so we're like the DJ is spinning tracks, like on my shoulders, essentially. You know, there's like this little wall there. So we're hanging out and talking and like, oh, this song is awesome. This is so fun. And then he puts on a song and it's not as awesome. And it's like, oh, what an idiot. I can't believe he played this song. And you can see people on the dance floor having a great time. And then he puts on a different song and people start walking away from the dance floor. So we're making all these judgments and, you know, a lot of comments and it's loud. So we're shouting all the comments and so we're trying to talk to each other. So Ez, I'm backed up against the DJ and Ez comes and she's facing me, talking to me. And she's shouting about the poor song choices that this DJ is making. Just like really ripping into him. You've met my wife. She's brutal. And so she's just like really laying into this. And I'm laughing because she's not wrong. And we're having this great time. And then I turn around and I realize there's not actually a window there like we thought. There's nothing separating my wife's shouting about this DJ except my head, which is formidable, but you know, she's just like shouting, I can't believe he's playing this song. I could pick better songs than this. I don't think he actually heard anything because he had the, you know, the headphones on, all that stuff. But it was this immediate realization. And in this dark room, you could just see her begin to turn bright red of like, oh my gosh, what did I say? Did he hear what I said? How much did he hear? Have you guys ever had an opportunity to say something and then recognize that it might have been a little bit louder than what you thought? Maybe you've been the person at a restaurant sitting at a table listening to other tables' conversations. It's like, oh my gosh, can you hear what they're saying? You know, it's like you got like radar going on. It's crazy to think about how much we talk. And some of us are blessed with loud, booming voices. And so everything I say is louder than I think it is. And it gets me into trouble sometimes. But it's crazy to think about not only how much I say, which is a lot, too much in some people's opinions, but also how much I say that I don't think people hear me say. How many conversations I'm having with someone that other people overhear, not because they're trying to be sneaky, but just because that's the reality of life. You hear what's going on. How many snippets of a conversation people hear? How many one-line thoughts or half-baked ideas people hear? My My iPhone has this feature. I don't know if your Android phones do this. I've never touched an Android phone in my life. So, but iPhone users, you know that we have this thing called, I'm going to blank on it now. Gosh. Screen time. That's the word I'm looking for, screen time, and it's in your settings. You can go and look at it, and if you turn it on, each week it'll give you a report of how much time you spend on your phone. And then if you click on it, you can like double click, and it'll tell you how much time you spend on specific apps, and how much, you know, how many hours of your day, or, you know, whatever it might be. And I'm going to be honest with you guys, it never feels like I'm on my phone as much as my screen time says I'm on my phone. It's constantly like, are you kidding me? That's how much I was on that? I was thinking about it with this topic, with this conversation. I wonder if what it would look like if we had that type of feature with our conversations, with our words. I wonder what the report would say. What are the things that we talk about the most? I know for some of you, you're heading into fantasy football season, so there's going to be a whole lot of football conversations. I know for some of you, there's a new Netflix show or whatever it is. And so there's all kinds of things that take this thing. And I wonder how much we're aware of the quantity or the amount of hours that we're actually spending talking about this stuff. Obviously, the conversation that we're having in this series is about politics. And I've been saying each week, this series isn't about how you vote. This is about how we relate with each other, how we care, how we love others, how we keep the topic of politics from destroying relationships. And the reality is that even for people that don't really like to talk about politics, it's kind of gotten ingrained in so many aspects of life that it feels like everything is like somewhat politic adjacent, at least. And I wonder how much we really spend time talking about this, how many comments we make, or jokes, or memes, or posts, or whatever it is that we're engaging around this topic. I would imagine it's probably a lot more than we think, because we're not really good judges of how much time or energy we spend on something. My son loves playing Nintendo Switch. We have a similar type of situation where he gets a certain amount of time each day, and it never fails. Every single day, it's like, what? The time is up already? I've only been playing it for like 2 minutes. I was like, well, you had 2 hours today. So that's how much time you spent on it. But we all have this, we're unable to see how much time is it that we're actually spending on this thing? How much time is it that I'm spending on my phone, on this app? How much time am I spending in these conversations? How much is this topic leaking into my conversations and life with other people? It would be an interesting thing to learn. And the reality is, it's not wrong to talk about these things. It's not wrong to talk about football or music or movies or even politics. But it's so crucial for us to recognize the reality that when we talk about politics, other people feel some kind of way. Other people feel something. They experience it in a certain way. And we don't always get to control how they experience it. And it's not up for us to control how other people react or respond. And I want to be really clear today. What we're talking about is how do we begin to become aware of what our words provoke and spark in others. We have a responsibility to be aware of the words that we use, the ways we talk about things, the things we post or repost or share or whatever it might be. We have a responsibility for ourselves to be aware of that. And it's not that we can't talk about politics. I just wonder if we recognize how much we do talk about it and the effect that it has on people around us. There's a research professor of psychology at USC, and they did this big study, and he said it this way. He said, when your political views are challenged, the brain becomes active in regions associated with personal identity, threat response, and emotions. I don't think any of us are too surprised by that. We've seen that play out over the last, especially like maybe 5-6 years. It's been a lot of that. But identity, that's what we talked about a couple weeks ago. We're more identifying who we are. Part of our identity is our political preference and leaning. Threat response, which feels strong. But as we saw in the story last week, some people want to fight about this physically, with their words, shouting, whatever it is, powering up to win. And emotions. Political beliefs are important to our identity and to our sense of who we are. They're a part of our social selves as well, and they can define who we spend time with and how they relate to us. And so my point in showing you this is that it's to help us begin to recognize that when we talk about politics, and it's not that you can't or that you shouldn't. It's just that we need to recognize that it's not a neutral reality for people. It's part of their identity. If it's an opposing view, there's a threat response that happens physiologically and emotionally in our brains. There's a reaction, and we may not always see it, but it's really important for us to recognize that if we are assuming that our political commentary doesn't have a negative impact on others, we're wrong. We would be wrong to assume that our political commentary isn't having a negative or adverse effect on others. And by commentary, I know none of us, well, I don't know for sure, but I'm imagining none of us have a talk show about politics. But commentary is what you post or repost on social media. Commentary is the pictures and the memes that you send out to your group texts. It's the shirts that you wear, the bumper stickers that you put on your car. Commentary is all kinds of things. And if we just can't be at this place where we pretend like it's not sparking something in others. Now, for some, they'll be like, I like this guy. He thinks like I think. That guy's my new best friend. We're the same. I'm on his team. He's on my team. It's a good response, essentially. Well, leave good in quotes. It's a favorable response. But for others, it leads us to think some other things. I shared this research on our first week. I don't know if you remember it or if you were here, but there was a research report from 2022, and it found that a majority in both political parties, both primary political parties, view members of the other party as more immoral, dishonest, lazy, unintelligent, and close-minded than other Americans. And so if someone believes with your political commentary, you're buddies. And if somebody is on the other side of the line, they think that you are unintelligent, lazy, immoral, and dishonest. And obviously, that's not fair. It's not true for most of us. It's one of those things where it's like, well, that's not a healthy perspective. That's not real. But in our broken humanity, we have this response. We have this reaction. And so for us to recognize, man, with my political commentary, it is sparking something in some people. And just because of who I vote for or the policies that I support, some people are going to begin to think these things about me, whether they recognize it or not. Now, again, I'm not saying we can't talk about politics. I'm not saying you shouldn't take a stand on certain political things. What I want us to do, what's important for us to do for the sake of our relationships, for the sake of our unity, for the sake of the way that we're able to care and share God's love and God's message with the people in our world and neighborhoods around us, we need to just become aware that what I'm saying is impacting people in a specific way. What does it look like for us to become aware of that? And some of us might not care. It's like, I don't care if you think I'm a bad person. That's on you. And I would suggest that you should care. As followers of Jesus, we have a responsibility to care. It doesn't mean that we just never speak truth. It doesn't mean that we just allow ourselves to be taken advantage of or hurt, but we should care. And Paul, the apostle, cared, and this is what he said in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. He said, I'm not anyone's slave, but I've become a slave to everyone, so I can win as many people as possible. Some of us really love winning. It's a big deal to win. It's a good feeling. Winning an argument, winning a game, winning a battle for what restaurant we're going to have dinner at. Whatever the battle is, we like to win. And Paul's talking about this desire that he has to win as many people as possible. When it says win in red, I'd love for you guys to read that with me. When I'm with the Jews, I live like a Jew to win Jews. They are ruled by the law of Moses, and I'm not. But I live by the law to win them. And when I'm with other people who are not ruled by the law, I forget about the law to win them. Of course, I never really forget about the law of God. In fact, I'm ruled by the law of Christ, which is the law of love. He says, when I'm with people whose faith is weak, I live as they do to win them. I do everything I can to win everyone I possibly can. And I do all of this for the good news because I want to share in its blessings. Paul's talking about super religious Jewish people, which he self-identified in other places. He's like, man, I'm the most Jewish of them all. I have all of the things locked down. He's talking about Gentiles, people that are not a part of Israel, the Jewish faith or tradition, and other people, and how he's like, I'm not going to hold them to the expectations that the Jewish people have. There's a different thing, and I'm gonna live and speak in a certain way so I can reach them for the sake of winning them. And then for people who have a weak faith, I'm going to live and speak in a certain way so that I can win them. I'm going to do everything that I possibly can because I love winning, is what Paul says. But what is it that he wants to win? It's not his personal preferences or opinions. He's being incredibly cautious and intentional with how he speaks, with what he does, with the ways that he shows up, because of his desire to win people to the love of Christ, to the family of God. It is the most important thing for him. And he's willing to do almost anything to win almost anyone. And I wonder if any of us, myself included, have had that thought. If any of us have put that kind of winning as a priority in our lives. If any of us have thought about that type of decision and filtering how we act or speak or what we do or how we engage with other people. The reality is, for many of us, while we are trying to win people over to our side politically, we are alienating people spiritually. We're causing a reaction in them, and they're making a judgment, however unhealthy it might be, but it's putting distance. And every study and every research, and there's books about this. There's a book called The Righteous Mind, which is a great resource on this. Everybody says all of our attempts to convince people to change their political leaning are failing. There's no argument that you can make that's going to convince people because of our physiology, because of that threat response, because it's tied to our identity. They have found that the success and the impact is always in relationship and conversations around who people are, the things we talked about last week, about their perspectives, their experiences, and sharing our perspectives and our experiences. It's never in a win or lose argument. It's always over time in a relationship. And Paul is convinced. And when he articulated his focus, I think that he also defined what our focus should be as well. What are we trying to win people to? What do we think that the greatest hope is for our neighbors? What do we think that they need to experience most in their life? What gospel are we proclaiming? What good news? Is it the good news of Rome, or is it the good news of Jesus? Is it the power of Rome to save, or is it the power of Jesus to save? Is it the peace that comes by the military strength of Rome, or is it the peace that comes from Jesus that surpasses all understanding? We have to wrestle with what this looks like. And the unfortunate reality is that a lot of us have sacrificed influence with people in our lives because of the political commentary that we have participated in. John Maxwell famously talks about how influence takes years to build and seconds to lose. And there's a lot of things that are worth taking a stand on. And again, I feel like I've said this a few times, but I just want to make sure I got to sprinkle in this like PSA every couple of minutes. I'm not telling you what you can and can't take a stand on. I'm inviting you to become more aware of our political commentary and the effect that it has on others. And is it the desired effect? Is it the hope that we want it to have? Is it the impact that we want it to have? There's lots of things worth taking a stand on, but I would suggest that that list might be a little shorter or maybe a little bit different than what we think. With every conversation that we have, we can wrestle with the reality that we are building influence in someone's life or we're diminishing it. And this isn't even just about politics. When you have a conversation with someone who feels caring and loving and for you, there is a sense of the way that you value who they are and the way that they're supporting and encouraging you. There's this influence that they're building by being loving in that way. And when you interact with people that are unkind or cruel or critical, is diminishing the influence that they have in your life. And the same thing is true as we talk about politics. Our conversations are shaping the influence that we have. And the reality is, in this world, we like to put people in buckets. There is nobody that gets to be kind of Republican or kind of Democrat now. It's like you're one or the other. You're all in or you're all out. And I think the majority of us don't actually like that. But the loudest voices are saying that this is the way that it has to be. And so for us, when we take a stand politically, when we lead with politics, the reality is that we often end up alienating half the people from one of the most powerful messages possible, which is the good news of Jesus. Miss Lauryn Hill said it this way: you might win some, but you just lost one. And it feels great when we get to take a stand and everybody laughs and we all agree because we're on the same page, but there's one person who's not responding in your group thread, who's bothered, who's hurt, who thinks differently of you now because of the funny joke, which may be funny, and it may even be mostly true. But is it worth it to win some and lose one? Paul doesn't seem like it's worth it. He's going to do whatever he can to win as many as he can. Jesus talked a lot about pursuing even just one. So we have to wrestle with this. And I think the thing I want us to hold on to today is that we should never burn a relational bridge over a political view. We should never feel so comfortable or so confident in our political perspective or stance that we're willing to burn a relational bridge. We're willing to start eroding a relationship and the influence that we have in other people's lives over our political perspectives. So how do we win people like Paul? What does it look like for us to continue keeping influence in how we impact others? There's three things I want to look at. Extend grace, stop arguing, and do good. Extend grace, stop arguing, and do good. We're going to look at each one of these things. The first one is Colossians 4. Paul's writing this as well. He says, be wise in the way that you act towards outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversations be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. Paul is writing this, and last week in our sermon, we talked about how it was really focused on the ways that we interact with each other as Jesus followers. Jesus prayed that we would be one, that we would be unified. And last week, it was how do we make sure that we are loving and unified together as followers of Jesus. And this week is really primarily focused on how do we relate to the world outside, people that are not Christians, people that haven't put their faith in Jesus. And Paul's saying we need to be wise in the way that we act towards outsiders and make the most of every opportunity. And then he says, be full of grace, seasoned with salt. And I think a lot of us get the recipe wrong. It's full of salt, very salty, heavy on the salt, with a dash of grace. And we've probably all done the classic baking mistake where you mix up the sugar and the salt, or it's not good that way. But we love the idea of being the one to convince someone else that they're wrong. We love the idea of the one to be able to prove someone else's point is wrong. And so we keep pouring on the salt in hopes that I get the win. But it's the wrong win that we're fighting for. We need to be full of grace and seasoned with salt, seasoned with truth, but overflowing, doused with grace. We have to extend grace. The second thing is we need to stop arguing, which is so fun to say and hard to do. I love arguing. I argue a lot with my kids. One of my wife's favorite things to say to us is stop arguing. Because we'll just argue in circles, and nobody ends up having a good time. And the reality is the same for us as Jesus followers. In Philippians, Paul writes, do everything without grumbling or what? Arguing. So that you may become pure and blameless. if you can avoid arguing and grumbling, you get to become pure and blameless. And then he says, you'll become children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation. And then you will shine among them like stars in the sky. When we stop arguing, when we stop engaging with these circle fights where it just goes round and around and we're lobbing things out at people on the internet and we've got stuff posted on our bumper stickers and our shirts and all these different things, when we stop arguing and grumbling, it allows us to shine like stars. It allows us to become pure and blameless, that we could stand out in a different way. And that light, I would argue, is more crucial than a political light. It's a light that's drawing people to something more hopeful, more powerful, and more impactful. We'll shine bright for the right things. And then the third piece is to do good, which seems like a really easy kind of church answer. It's like in Sunday school when you ask a question and the kids just all say, Jesus. Like, yeah, do good. Do good. Jesus, in his Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, he said, you are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. In the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. It's interesting, because there's other spots in the scripture where it talks about not letting your right hand know what your left hand is doing. And there's a lot of people that's like, well, I'm not doing it for the recognition. I'm not going to do good. I don't want everybody to know that I did this. And I get that. And there's times when that's appropriate. But Jesus is specifically saying that you should allow your good deeds, that they should be visible. People should be able to see the good things that you're doing in your relationships and in your community. We know the phrase, actions speak louder than words. And I think that that's a little bit of what Jesus is getting to. There's a sense of the way that you live and relate and interact, it will point people to something bigger and more beautiful than anything they could experience in their own humanity. What does it look like for us to not just be super smart about politics, not just be able to win a verbal battle to be able to prove someone wrong, but what does it look like for us to actually care for people? Because those can be very different things. What does it look like for us to love others well, to put ourselves aside as second, to make others first? Like our scripture for the church this year, it's also in Philippians. It's not considering only our preferences, but for those around us as well. What is it that they need? How can we care for them? What does it look like to do good? And in our actions and the way that we live, it's not about the correct perspective or stance that we might have in regards to politics, but it's in our willingness to love others well. There's a pastor named Andy Stanley, and he said it this way. He said, being right doesn't make us shine. Being right doesn't make us shine. Winning an argument doesn't make us shine. Having the correct information doesn't make us shine. It's doing good. It's loving others well. It's avoiding arguments and grumbling that makes us shine among other people like stars in the sky. Many of us believe different than non-Christians, but we don't always behave much different. And do you know how non-Christians expect us to act? Like Jesus. They may not know a lot about Christianity, but almost everyone will be like, yeah, Jesus was a good guy. If that's who you follow, then that's great. How dare they expect us to act like Jesus? How dare they expect us to be kind and loving and to serve others and to be self-sacrificial? They have every right, even if they don't believe the same thing as us. They have every right to expect us to live out what we claim to believe to be true. It's our goodness towards others that points people to Jesus. So we have to extend grace, stop arguing, and do good. I've talked about this a little bit before. I grew up in North Carolina. Same response as I had first service. Thank you. And North Carolina is well known for a number of different things. And I'm sure, as you all know, also, it's well known as the NASCAR Hall of Fame is in North Carolina, right? Did you guys know that?
Wow.
Thank you, Kathy. I got to plant more people in the office next week, or in the room. In the South, really just kind of in general, NASCAR is a big deal. But in North Carolina, we've got Charlotte Motor Speedway, the Hall of Fame. NASCAR is a really big deal in the South. I grew up a big fan of Richard Petty and Kyle Petty. Nope, anybody? The Mellow Yellow car. Oh, come on. Okay. It's fine, you guys. I've made judgments on you based on your lack of knowledge. I'm just kidding. These cars are wildly expensive. I actually don't actually like NASCAR that much, but I have gotten into Formula One a lot more recently. That's exciting. Anyways, these cars are crazy expensive. NASCAR, one individual car can cost about $600,000, and that's not counting the additional cars that they need for damage, the parts, the tires, all the different stuff. I mean, it's a wildly expensive sport. And so they obviously aren't going to pay for this themselves. They get sponsors. And there's different levels. There's three kind of primary levels. There's a primary sponsor. They pay a lot of money, and they get 5 spots on the car. There's like secondary sponsors. They get like little logos on the car. And then there's people that just kind of give things to the team. But to be a primary sponsor, they pay about $400,000 per race. And over a 38-race season, sometimes they'll pay up to $35 million. Obviously, it depends on if the car is good. You pay more for good cars and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But also, a lot of the primary sponsors, they're like, you know what? I want to make sure that we get as much space on this car as possible, so we're going to buy out the other sponsor places as well. So it's not just the one. They're buying all of them because they want people to know what their product is. And we'll see if it works. I got a couple pictures here. We're all visual learners. Anybody know who sponsors this car?
Pennzoil.
I knew you guys love NASCAR. You knew that right away. Okay, let's get another one. McDonald's. Next, M&M's. Yeah. Did you guys know there's a Cheez-It NASCAR? I mean, that's a team worth supporting. Is there another one? Yeah. Reddit. Who'd have thunk that Reddit would have made it into NASCAR, you know? It's like if there's a sponsorship that I never would have imagined. It is crazy how much these sponsors pay to make sure that nothing distracts anybody from their brand name. And what I want to suggest to us today is that the same is true for us. The same is true for us. Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 said, "You are not your own. You were bought at a price." You and I were bought and redeemed at a price, a high price. The price of Christ, because of his deep love for us and his desire to be restored in relationship and see us experience healing and restoration and wholeness and forgiveness, he went to the cross and gave his life for us. We were bought at a price. We are not our own. But so many of us start putting other labels and brands on ourselves and starts to distract from whose we are, from the primary identity that we're called to have. We begin to put on other sponsors and people start to get distracted and wonder, like, well, what is the most important thing in this person's life? How do they make decisions? I'd be willing to bet that almost none of us recognized those tiny other little sponsor stickers and could maybe list off one or two, but we could probably remember every one of those primary sponsors. And for us, what does it mean for us to say, I was bought with a price, I am not my own, and I belong to God, and I want to represent God well? And it doesn't mean that I can't talk about politics. It doesn't mean that I shouldn't take a stand for what I believe is important. But it does mean that I do need to recognize that I represent, and forgive me for using this language, but I represent my sponsor. And it's so much more than that. We are image bearers of God. What would it look like for us to recognize this reality? And over the last few years, there's been so much dialogue in sports because there's more messages that have been brought into sports and sponsors and things like this. And I've heard so many people say, like, man, I don't want to watch it anymore because it's no longer about the main thing. There's like all these other messages that are muddying. I just want to watch baseball. And then we turn around and we do the same thing with our lives. We muddy it up with so many things. It doesn't mean they're not important. It doesn't mean we can't have a stand. But we need to recognize that we are detracting. And we are not going to win what Jesus has called us to win, which is other people to the hope of the world. Are we willing to prioritize our faith over politics? Because I never want to burn a relational bridge over a political view. It's a question I want us to wrestle with this week. You should ask yourself, consider, is my political commentary creating an unnecessary distraction from Jesus? It's my political commentary. And again, this is a broad top, it's a big bucket of things that could fall into this. And maybe it's not. And maybe this isn't something that you wrestle with, but I think it's an important thing for us to ask ourselves. Because we are not our own. We were bought with a price. And what does it look like? I know that there are many people who have had that still small voice, that little angel on their shoulder, and they've decided to not post something. I'm sure that's happened in all of our lives. We've decided to not make that statement or that joke. I'm sure we have all done that. But I only know of one person that has specifically gone through the steps of removing items from their home and their car because through conversations, they realized that their political commentary was keeping others from recognizing who Jesus was in their lives. They had a flag that they flew in their yard, and they were proud of it. And right or wrong, it's like, it was their choice. But I only know of one person in my life, I'm sure there's more, who was willing to say, you know what? You know what's more important than this flag, political flag? You know what's more important than making this statement? The fact that there's something that's distracting people from the greatest hope in my life. What would it look like if we were willing to do that? We're willing to use our power, our vote, our influence, the way that our faith calls us to use it. We're active, but we're also being intentional in the way that we care for others, in the good that we do, in the way that we stop trying to win the wrong arguments, in the ways that we extend grace. Let's pray together. Well, regardless of where you may be at in your faith journey, I believe that everyone has a next step that they can take. If you'd like more information about what it means to put your trust in Jesus, information about getting baptized, or maybe even attending a Discover class to grow more in your faith, you can visit us online at southhills.org/Costa Mesa, and then scroll down to the Next Steps section. If you'd like more information about tithing or supporting South Hills financially, you can visit southhills.org/giving. Thanks again for listening today, and I hope that I get to see you soon.